conducting interviews with lunar citizens. It would be just like the opposition to plant someone who could convince you how evil everyone is down here. At least a few of them are actors. Best, Obi-Wan thought, to sidestep this. We're not conducting in-depth interviews. Just learning more about the terrain we must search. Master Jin and I would need to be prepared for any confrontation that might lie ahead. The diversion worked. But you're Jedi, Fanry said. How could you not be victorious? You have your lightsabers, don't you?
We do, Obi-Wan said, pointing at his blade where it hung at his belt. But lightsabers aren't that useful against bombs.
Aren't they?
Fanry wrinkled her nose.
After all these years, the Lord Regent has still never shown me the exact workings of his lightsaber, so I thought maybe there was some big secret about how they operate.
Not at all, Your Serene Highness.
Should you have said that? Maybe Avaros had lied about it to keep her from treating his weapon like a toy. Fanry was old enough now to hear the truth.
The construction of lightsabers isn't mysterious, though there are elements that ensure the weapons will always remain singular to the Jedi.
What do you mean?
Fanry asked.
Well,
Obi-Wan considered for a second, then set his lightsaber on a small table near the princess and began to disassemble it.
I'll show you the inner workings and explain from there.
Fanry bit her lower lip.
You won't break it.
He stifled a laugh.
No, Your Serene Highness. We're required to know how to disassemble and reassemble our lightsabers in the dark. A Jedi's lightsaber is his life.
With Fanry and her ministers leaning in intently, and Darren suddenly at his side, Obi-Wan carefully unscrewed the pommel cap and hand grip, then revealed the lightsaber's core.
Here you see the controls, and the main hilt.
What's that?
She pointed straight to the gleaming heart of his lightsaber. Is it a jewel? In effect, it's a kyber crystal, which focuses the power of the lightsaber's beam.
Amid the metal workings surrounding it, the kyber crystal sparkled tantalizingly. While the rest was a machine, the crystal looked more like magic. He couldn't blame Fanry for her fascination. He'd felt the same way when he first learned how to assemble a lightsaber. Still felt that way sometimes.
It's blue, isn't it? Fanry said curiously. Are all lightsaber blades blue?
The kyber crystals do determine the color of the blade, but they only take on their colors after their bond with the Jedi who've chosen them.
Fanry's eyes widened.
Kyber crystals bond with Jedi? Does that mean you communicate with them?
With a grin, he said,
No, just their particular properties are affected by their proximity to a Force user.
Very swiftly, the bond forms, and then the kyber crystals change.
Most turn blue or green, which is why most Jedi's lightsabers are those colors. A few crystals even turn purple.
Purple?
Fanry laughed.
Is that what you wished for? Do any of the colors mean something?
Legend had it true darkness, such as that wielded by the ancient Sith, turned crystals red. But Obi-Wan had no intention of discussing ancient history with the princess.
I was just happy to have a kyber crystal bond with me at all, Your Serene Highness. Lightsabers are the sole weapon of the Jedi,
Minister Orth interjected.
Are they not?
Obi-Wan shook his head.
They're far from the only tool we have at our disposal. But in combat, a lightsaber is an unparalleled weapon for both attack and defense. And because using the blade requires immense concentration and keen reflexes, no one but a Force user can wield lightsabers skillfully or efficiently.
Fanry said,
Is a stronger Force user's lightsaber stronger too? What happens when two Jedi fight each other?
The blade isn't stronger.
Only the Force user's ability to wield it, Obi-Wan said. In ceremonial combat, of course we're displaying forms more than actually testing strength. But what about non-ceremonial combat?
Fanry persisted.
When two Jedi are on opposite sides of a conflict, what happens?
It
doesn't happen. The idea made so little sense that Obi-Wan could hardly parse it. We are members of one order. We serve the Jedi Council and through the Council of the Republic. The Jedi are united in this way.
Well, that's boring.
Scowling, Fanry kicked her little feet beneath her throne.
And nobody but the Jedi ever uses lightsabers? You'd never fight anyone else who had one? For real, I mean. Not ceremonially.
The ancient Sith used lightsabers, Obi-Wan said. But they've been extinct for a millennium. So no. A Jedi just wouldn't be involved in a lightsaber duel to the death. It couldn't happen.
Fanry seemed to realize she was being a bit bloodthirsty because she smiled impishly and made the next question a joke.
Never.
He smiled back as he shook his head.
Not ever.
Chapter 17. A royal ship found itself unable to take off when a dozen green-clad people perched on its hull, then tethered themselves in place with magnetic bonds. One of them was Halen Azaka herself, her hair braided into tight knots she wore like a crown. Security droids arrived quickly, but at their first appearance, the protesters activated personal flight packs and managed to escape. Pygel had been building a magnificent hall of assembly to house its new representative government, an entirely spherical structure with a mirrored surface, which would appear almost invisible until sundown, when the last rays of light would make it burn like another star. Security cams captured the moment late at night when the mirrors turned cloudy, then totally gray, then crumbled to dust. Only later did investigators determine that nanotech had been planted inside and had devoured the building's framework from within. Panic had broken out one night when the moon of Pygel rose in the sky, no longer golden green but a stark ominous red. The opposition turned out to have extensively seeded the moon's atmosphere with a harmless chemical that would disperse within a few days, but ensured the moon would remain crimson the whole time. On the next morning, an ominous message was discovered, painted on one of the larger temples in the capital. Can you forget us now? A droid rolled into a Zerka facility, seen on various security cams, until it suddenly exploded. The resulting flames burned so hot they were blue in the night. Had any living being been within the facility at that late hour, they would surely have been killed. And they couldn't have known the facility would be completely empty. Qui-Gon pointed out as he shut off the hollows of known opposition actions. Darren had been reluctant to share them. His paranoia about protecting Fanry had grown. Qui-Gon had insisted on having them, but had waited until late in the evening to review them with Obi-Wan, when they could be alone. Obi-Wan looked thoughtful.
No, they couldn't. Anyone might have decided to return to work, or a servant might have been forced to stay behind for some reason. Whoever did this was willing to risk taking lives.
So it would seem, Qui-Gon replied. He stroked his beard, considering the possibilities.
Chancellor Karsh told us the opposition's violence was escalating, Obi-Wan said. But the behavior seems more erratic to me. Not something that could be plotted on a line.
The various incidents are wildly discordant. Nor do they follow a straight chronology. Some of the more harmless incidents occur after the bombings began.
Maybe some of the pranks were programmed before the violence escalated, Obi-Wan said. Then his eyes widened. Or maybe there's not one single head of the opposition, but many. Halen Azaka could just be the one leader we know about. There could be other cells, both more and less violent. All of them working toward one cause, but in very different ways.
A valid theory, my Padawan.
Qui-Gon still sensed there was more to the puzzle, but he felt certain the shift in pattern was important.
Rael considers all of this to be mindless violence. pure terrorism. I suspect that's why he didn't recognize this pattern himself.
Obi-Wan said nothing. Qui-Gon was relieved.
Whenever Obi-Wan doubted Rael, the impulse to defend his old friend strengthened. That impulse interfered with Qui-Gon's judgment. Rahara objected to Pax's plan. Sometimes Pax felt as though she objected to any and all fun purely on principle. This time, however, he understood her concern. But he still intended to ignore it.
You want to deal with Zerka, she said, arms folded as she dressed for the big meeting to come. They're scum.
No, worse. They'd have to work their way up to scum. Pax examined his best coat, blue, oversized, velvet lapels, then regretfully laid it aside. Pyjali citizens were so boring in their attire. Sadly for the galaxy, the scum often winds up with a great deal of money.
Blood money, Rahara insisted. They've made untold trillions over untold centuries, largely through slave labor. Zerka's money is tainted forever.
I quite understand your point of view.
Then why? How can you be willing to do business with the company who...
Her words trailed away. It didn't matter. Pax knew what she meant.
Zerka treated you abominably, he said, settling on a black cape that looked rather dashing, if he did say so himself. Their slavery practices are worthy of the deepest contempt.
The company deserves not one chit of its gargantuan wealth.
Which is why I consider it my moral duty to deprive them of as much of that wealth as I can.
Rahara tilted her head.
You mean you're going to scam them?
It will appear to be an honest mistake.
Pax gestured toward the pile of cola and crystals he'd gathered together.
So few people can tell the difference between these and true Kyber. It could take them quite a while to figure it out. Long enough for us to have left Pyjal, even.
So I foresee no negative repercussions for us.
Only for the vipers of Zerka Corporation.
I guess I can see the good in that.
One corner of her mouth lifted. Not quite a smile. Still, it brightened Pax's mood considerably.
But be careful.
Of course.
Pax gathered the crystals into a small anti-grav crate. He'd be able to fit this aboard his single pilot craft.
I know perfectly well what Zerka is capable of.
So he said, and so he believed, the entire way to the nearest Zerka office. Naturally, he couldn't bring the Merricks on this errand, but he had a single pilot craft, which he'd dubbed the Facet, stashed in the hold for just such occasions. Really, he thought he ought to take it out more. He ought to improve his flying, if only to keep up with Rahara. After he'd landed the Facet, gone to the guard station, and gained admittance, however, he was walked through the workyard. There he saw a group of enslaved people in their gray coveralls at hard labor. The labor was far from the worst that could be assigned, nor was it the worst Pax had ever personally witnessed. They were merely polishing and cleaning an elegant personal craft, probably the supervisors. So it wasn't the nature of the work that struck him. It was that all the workers were children. The oldest human couldn't have been 9 years old yet. Pax wasn't as good at estimating the ages of Ithorians, but the one scrubbing hard where the cloth was the tiniest he'd ever seen. The Wookiee looked older, though it was hard to determine his height. He hung his head so sadly. One of his hands had been shaved to insert the Zerka tag, and the fur hadn't grown back yet. This child had been enslaved for only a few days.
Rahara was even younger than this,
Pax thought, as he followed the security guard, guiding his crate. Suddenly he wasn't sure he'd be able to put on a smile for any Zerka officials, even if it was in the noble cause of ripping them off.
He suspected he didn't put on a very convincing performance for the sector supervisor, but it hardly mattered. As soon as Merritt Call opened the crate to see the crystals, what, as far as she knew, was a treasure trove of Kyber, her attention was purely focused there.
"You say these are found extensively throughout this region of the moon?"
Call held one crystal up to the light. It shone as bright and orange as the skies of Abafar.
"Indeed, Supervisor Call. Keep it cool, keep it steady, pretend you're G-3PO.
I was so excited at first, but an independent trader like me, how am I supposed to do business with the Jedi Order?"
"It's very insightful of you,"
Call said, smiling not at Pax, but at the crystals.
"Few independent traders would be as ready to face their own inadequacies."
"Inadequacies?" Pax held on to his temper. Barely. Half of them wanted to explain all the ingenious ways he'd already planned to work with the Jedi Order, had this stuff proved to be true, Kyber. Fortunately, the other half won out. Ultimately, he made a deal for a large sum. Not enough for him and Rahara to retire, but more than enough to upgrade the ship and take a long vacation. Pax had considered negotiating for more, but the bigger Zerka's payout was, the more suspicious they would be of the person who'd sold them a useless box of Kolen.
"You see?"
he thought as he flew away in the facet. "It was worth sticking around for a while, Jedi or no Jedi. You've pulled more of a profit on this than you will from the Aldoran Hall."
All very true, but he couldn't look at the credits without hearing Rahara's voice whispering in his head. Blood money.
"No comms, Master?"
Obi-Wan felt naked without the comm device he'd worn in his belt as long as he could remember.
"What if someone needs to reach us?"
"The only individuals who could need to urgently talk to us will be on the Grand Hunt, too,"
Qui-Gon said.
"Besides, it's custom to leave behind all advanced technological devices. Apparently, centuries ago, people used them to cheat."
To Obi-Wan, it sounded primitive to the point of barbarity, but following local traditions and habits were encouraged, so he resisted the urge to go back for the comm device. Instead, he and Qui-Gon marched across the rolling ground toward the stables. High grasses swayed and parted for them as they went. In the distance, he could see torches blazing, actual torches, against the deep purple of late sunset. Musicians had begun to play, and more people were headed toward the starting ground. Qui-Gon gave him an appraising glance.
"You haven't ridden much up until now, have you, Padawan?"
"No, Master, but it doesn't look so difficult."
"Depends on your mount."
Qui-Gon looked amused.
"Just remember, riding a living thing is different from riding a ship or speeder. The Force binds you together. You can use that."
Although Obi-Wan had looked the creatures up beforehand, he was still taken aback by his first glimpse of a Varactyl. Its scarlet feathers glimmered iridescently in the torchlight, and it pawed at the ground, eager to begin. They were huge, and when he thought about trying to get atop one, they seemed even huger.
"Here you go,"
Qui-Gon said, a roguish smile on his face.
He patted the side of one Varactyl, which chirruped at him.
"It's all ready for you, yes?"
When the attendant nodded, Qui-Gon motioned toward the saddle.
"Why don't you see if you can get up there?"
His master was enjoying his confusion. Not meanly, because that wasn't Qui-Gon's way, but that didn't make it less irritating. Obi-Wan tried to ignore Qui-Gon and any other person was watching to think only about the Varactyl. And then he felt it. The beast's soul, simpler and purer than that of a sentient, yet still intelligent in its way. When it cocked its head to study him, Obi-Wan realized this could not be a matter of his mastering the Varactyl. Instead, they would have to meet as equals. He put one hand on the Varactyl's neck, stroking the feathers. It chirruped again, And the end of its tail flicked once. From excitement, Obi-Wan thought. Perhaps it was looking forward to the hunt as much as any of the humans were. Through the Force, he sent back his own dawning enthusiasm for the event. The Viractyl ruffled its feathers, then crouched low on the ground until its belly lay in the grass. That let Obi-Wan easily swing up into the saddle and take the reins. Rising to its feet, the Viractyl chirruped happily. They were friends now, Obi-Wan realized. Friends who were about to have a lot of fun together.
"Well done," Qui-Gon said. His expression was a mixture of amusement and wonder. "Very well done indeed."
Obi-Wan leaned down to whisper in the Viractyl's ear.
"He says you've done well."
It thumped the ground with its tail, which he instinctively knew was a good sign. Was it possible riding might even be more fun than flying? Applause, muffled through gloves of shimmer silk and velvet, made him look up. Two handlers were leading out an unusual droid, a modified crab droid by the looks of it. Was it of Zerka manufacture? Its dark surface made it all but invisible in the encroaching dusk. Soon, only the blue and white lights on its many-jointed legs would betray its place.
"The prey," Obi-Wan said.
Qui-Gon, who'd managed to get on his own Viractyl, if not quite so gracefully, nodded.
"Thousands of years ago, of course, they hunted live game. That practice was abandoned long ago."
"That's a relief," Obi-Wan said. "I don't know if I could have killed a living creature merely for sport, or helped anyone else do it either."
"Don't be too relieved," Qui-Gon sounded amused. "The main motivation for hunting a droid rather than an animal was increasing the level of challenge. A droid has defenses and resources no living creature could ever claim."
More applause heralded the arrival of Princess Fenri. Her Viractyl's feathers were all tipped with white, which made it the most striking of all the beasts. Obi-Wan wondered if it had been chosen for its appearance alone, or whether it was fast, too. Already he wanted his Viractyl to win. Fanry's riding habit was plain in Pajali style, a sandy color of no particular note, but with wide sleeves and a shorter hem that revealed the brilliant green underdress beneath. The servant girl Katie walked alongside her, carrying a basket that seemed to be piled high with whatever luxuries the princess might desire during the course of the night. Fanry's expression was more serious than he'd ever seen it, even when discussing the opposition attacks.
"Is that a sign that she's frivolous and cares for nothing but her amusements?"
Obi-Wan wondered.
"Or is it a sign of how important this hunt is on Pajal?"
More applause and cheers as Rael Avaros rode up in his Viractyl. He held up one hand, simultaneously acknowledging the crowd and hushing them. The man's rugged riding gear contrasted less with his shaggy hair and unshaven face than the regent's robes did. This was the first time Obi-Wan thought he'd seen Rael fully in his element. Rael's lopsided grin suggested he enjoyed this even more than he let on, and he let on a fair bit. Obi-Wan's Viractyl ruffled its feathers.
"The others are larger than you, I know," he murmured. "But that means you're faster. We'll capture the prey. Wait and see."
But there was more happening here than the Grand Hunt. Princess Fenri was in danger. From someone on the inside, someone who might be on this hunt. If anyone tried to hurt her, that person became his new prey.
"Assemble!" called the herald, and the riders and Viractyls all took their positions.
Wordlessly, Obi-Wan steered away from Qui-Gon to the other edge of the crowd. The farther apart they were, the more ground they could cover. By now the sky was almost purely dark, and the torchlight seemed to blaze brighter. The smell of fresh-cut grass and damp ground filled the air. Obi-Wan felt his Viractyl tense under him, and the energy was catching. He could see it in everyone around him. Captain Darren, flanking the princess, was smiling broadly, the only time Obi-Wan had ever glimpsed that.
Even Minister Orth's hair was down, and she'd tied a scarf around her neck, maybe so it could ripple behind her in the wind. The horns blew once. Obi-Wan seized the reins tighter as his mount stamped its feet. Twice. Everyone leaned forward in their saddles. Beneath the murmur of activity, Obi-Wan could hear Avaros chuckling softly with anticipation. Three times! Go! The Viracto leapt forward at the moment Obi-Wan wished him to. He didn't think he'd made a move. Already the Force had tied them together, and now he knew that for the Viractyl, running was the greatest joy imaginable. So he leaned in, letting his ride choose their speed, but keeping them close to Princess Fanry. "There it is!" the princess cried. A flickering of light had betrayed the droid's location, in a thicket farther up the nearby hill. Fanry's Viractyl broke from the others, galloping over a trench. Some of the other Viractyls balked, but Obi-Wan's took the jump effortlessly. He didn't see Qui-Gon or Avaros make it over, but in only minutes, he sighted them atop the Viractyls at the far side of the hunting party. As darkness had deepened, the automatic sensors on the Viractyl harnesses had begun to turn a pale shade of purple, outlining the beasts' forms, painting their feathers more brightly, and casting eerie lights on the riders. It felt almost like being in a primitive simulator, Obi-Wan thought, except that no simulator could possibly match this. The cool air that smelled of conifers, the workings of the Viractyl's muscles that could be felt even through the saddle, and most of all the thrill that couldn't be experienced in mere fantasy. Only reality. Another trench, this one deeper and muddier than the last. Once again, Fanry soared effortlessly over it. More of the Viractyls shied from this trench, growing skittish long before they even reached it, but Obi-Wan reached through the Force to reassure his beast. "If you can't make the jump, I won't make you try. If you can, though, don't hold back." His Viractyl's answer came when he bounded across the trench without so much as a pause. Obi-Wan laughed out loud. Ha-ha! Finally, he'd be the one sharing adventures with his friends. It must have been tremendous back in more primitive times. To know that their survival depended on this, to race ahead on creatures far less tame than the one he rode now, to see monarchs genuinely desperate to protect their right to the throne. If Fanry had been crowned princess in those days, Obi-Wan thought, she would have fared just fine. Only a handful of riders had made it this far yet, and Fanry was the first among them. She urged her beast forward toward the faint lights of the crab droid flickering among the high grasses. Finding the prey was only the first part of the hunt. Outwitting the droid was the next, more difficult step, but he felt sure the kill would be hers, not because of a ceremony, but by right. Obi-Wan was impressed. Nothing stood between Fanry and victory. Until the dark underbrush lit up with blaster bolts, firing at the princess.
Chapter 18.
Qui-Gon's Viractyl faltered at the second trench, rearing back. Only by clinging tightly to the saddle did Qui-Gon prevent being thrown off. I was a good rider once, he thought as he straightened himself, remembering a race he'd had with Dooku long ago. The memory shattered with the sound of Fanry's scream.
The princess! Darren shouted, and he turned his own beast into the trench, forcing it to run down and through. Qui-Gon followed along with the pack, or tried to. He was blocked by Minister Orth, who had lost control of her Viractyl entirely. Its feathers had fanned out into a ruff around its head as it hissed angrily. Orth, white-faced, simply clung to the saddle, apparently unable to manage anything else.
Blast it!
Qui-Gon stood in the stirrups to get a better view of the fray. In the meadow, he saw blaster bolts being fired from the underbrush that grew more thickly upon the hills of the hunting grounds. In the murk of nighttime, he couldn't make out who or what was firing. Each bolt illuminated another split second of the scene. Rael streaking toward the princess at top speed, Fanry ducking low over her ride, protecting herself, Obi-Wan charging toward the underbrush, his lightsaber shining in the night. Despite his fear, Qui-Gon felt a flush of pride. That was the apprentice he knew Obi-Wan could be, and the shadow of the great Jedi Knight he would yet become.
Assuming you don't both die here first. Now move!
When his mount balked again, Qui-Gon stopped fighting it, dropped the reins, and called on the Force to execute a jump that far exceeded anything a human could have done under his own strength. His boots thudded on the ground, but he sprang up instantly. His leap had brought him well over the trench, halfway to Fanry. As he landed, a flash of blaster fire from within the underbrush illuminated the attacker. And it was the prey. The crab droid had turned the ritual of the hunt upside down. The princess huddled behind her viractyl, but she had taken up her energy bow and fired over the beast's shoulder. The princess's spirit was stronger than her aim, though. The crab droid remained untouched. She was still in danger. Qui-Gon ran at top speed toward the fray that had ignited in the underbrush. Two lightsabers now shone in the night, both Obi-Wan's and Rael's. Rael's blade spun around like a windmill, blocking nearly every bolt fired. He was fighting defensively, protecting Fanry rather than going on the offensive. A wise move, given that Obi-Wan was already 2 meters ahead, slicing underbrush out of the way with every swing of his blade, clearing the way to the attacker. Qui-Gon reached out, sensing the patterns of force and fire, so he could run as quickly as possible to his Padawan's side.
About time you got here, Master!
Obi-Wan called, never looking away from the assault.
Thought I might lend a hand.
With that, Qui-Gon ducked low, igniting his own lightsaber to slash through the brush almost at ground level. At least the droid couldn't fly. Destroy the legs and the fight was over. Together, they pushed deeper into the brush. By now, Qui-Gon could peer through the brambles and see the prey droid with his own eyes. It didn't register him at all. This droid had been programmed with a ruthless single-mindedness. Even as he and Obi-Wan got closer, it fired directly at them no more than a handful of times.
Whoever did this wanted the droid to complete one task, Qui-Gon thought. Kill the princess.
Finally, Qui-Gon got close enough to stab his lightsaber blade beyond the final air bramble, through two of the crab droid's legs, straight into its base. It made a screeching sound, harsh with electronic interference, before sending out a spray of sparks and then going dead. Toppling sideways, it fell to the ground with a heavy thud. Some people cheered, but most of them were still screaming and weeping. Fanry had already stumbled out from behind her viractyl, alive and well, to be comforted by Rael. In the distance, Minister Orth was still struggling to get her viractyl under control. Obi-Wan wasn't even winded.
So, Master, he said, putting away his lightsaber, are any more of the upcoming coronation events this exciting?
I doubt it.
Qui-Gon didn't approve of his Padawan's cockiness, but let him enjoy the moment while he could. It hardly mattered. Had any of those blasts hit the princess, she would now be dead.
Animals. Monsters.
Avaros made himself think in those terms because he'd worked hard to break his habit of swearing when he'd come to help 6-year-old Fanry. But the profanities of a dozen worlds threatened to burst through at any moment. What about the treaty, the coronation? Anything about Fanry could make the opposition want to murder a young girl. Avaros put his hands on Fanry's shoulders and gentled her voice as much as he could.
Hey, kid, are you sure you're all right?
Bravely she nodded. I only scraped my knee when I slid off my viractyl.
Wasn't talking about your skin.
He meant her soul, though he was grateful not to have to say it out loud.
Fanry probably knew more about Avaros's soft side than anyone else living, but he didn't like to broadcast it even to her. Sure enough, she understood.
I'm fine. I think we all ought to have expected this.
You shouldn't have to expect people coming at you in the middle of a sacred ritual,
Avaros said, but he knew she was right. They couldn't afford to take anything for granted now. There was nothing the opposition wouldn't stoop to. No moment he could ever relax and assume Fanry was safe. Qui-Gon joined them, his expression grave.
I take it you're well, Your Serene Highness.
When Fanry nodded, he continued.
This is far worse than we knew. Yeah, because these lowlifes will stop at nothing.
Avaros stopped himself before he swore words that would fry Fanry's innocent ears.
Yes, they're ruthless, Qui-Gon agreed. But that's not what I meant. I reviewed the security measures alongside your rail. The stables and hunting ground had been extensively secured by droids, auto-sentries, and human guards. We even hired a few Rodian mercenaries, put them out in the far woodlands, Rail said. But somebody got to the prey droid anyway.
Qui-Gon lowered his voice.
Therefore, the droid could only have been sabotaged by someone within the palace.
The truth struck Rail with the force of a blow. He couldn't catch his breath, couldn't move. Because the greatest danger to Fanry came from one of her own courtiers or guards. From a traitor.
You think it's one of my people?
Fanry said to Qui-Gon, shaking her head in disbelief.
They've all been with me my entire life. None of them would try to kill me, not ever.
They set a slicer dart after you, Rail said. Whoever did that knew what that weapon meant to me. I don't like it any better than you do, Princess, but we've got to face facts. There's a traitor among us.
A traitor who is going to be very, very sorry for the brief remainder of his or her life. Fanry looked as though she didn't know whether to laugh or cry. Katie slipped a thick shawl over the princess's shoulders and led her away, no doubt for some water, quiet, and rest. Which left Avaros to stare at the group around him, wondering which individual could be cold enough to betray a little girl who'd put her trust in them all. The scene was almost pathetically comic. Orth was still flopping around on top of Arachdol like the terrible rider she was. A nobleman was whining about his torn doublet, which revealed the entire gold satin lining and was now too gaudy to be worn any place. How gauche! Captain Darren, at least, was proving himself useful by swiftly disassembling the droid down to its component gears, wiring, and panels. But the rest of the Pygel court was distinguishing itself mostly through its utter silliness.
At least there are two people here I know didn't betray her,
Avaros thought as he followed Qui-Gon to Obi-Wan's side.
Perhaps we should examine the droid's workings,
Obi-Wan was saying to Qui-Gon when he broke off at Avaros's approach.
How is the princess?
Avaros breathed out heavily, wiping sweat from his forehead with the back of his grimy hand.
She acts brave, but that shook her up.
And no wonder, Qui-Gon said. We'll have to go through security footage immediately.
Anybody smart enough to reprogram the prey droid smart enough to reprogram the security terminals,
Avaros muttered.
But we're going through them anyway. We see one shadow. I swear by the temple, I'll follow that shadow straight to the scumbag that tried to hurt her.
Qui-Gon remained almost damnably calm. Easy to be calm when you didn't really care about anyone involved.
Were you able to see anyone whose presence you can't explain? Maybe someone you thought was a sentry but wasn't in a pre-approved location? You think I wouldn't have mentioned that by now if I had? I was too busy saving Fanry to count heads.
Avaros saw Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan exchange a look. Most Jedi Knights would see it as their duty to remember every possible detail of an important battle or skirmish, so as to analyze it and extract maximum information. But when Rael Avaros was in a fight, he was fighting.
He wasn't going to let any Padawan sneer at him for it either. To Obi-Wan, he said,
"That okay with you?"
Obi-Wan's blue eyes widened.
I only meant...
You obviously protected the princess very ably. It used to be fun to shake the Padawans up like that, he remembered. There'd been a time when he could joke with Nim that way. Maybe that wasn't the kind of fun he needed to revisit. He called to the entire gathering.
The grand hunt is over! Now get yourselves back to your rooms and remain available for questioning. Nobody leaves the palace compound without my express permission. Got it!
The various nobles all nodded, murmuring among themselves as they began shuffling back to their viractals, obviously shaken and disappointed in equal measure. Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan were walking back already, talking to each other. And in the distance, Captain Darren was trying valiantly to get Minister Orth down from the saddle.
"Are you sure you're uninjured, Your Serene Highness?"
Katie asked. Fanry nodded, though one of her ankles twinged every time she stepped on it. Whatever was wrong there, it wasn't bad enough to require a medical droid's help, and besides, she wanted to be alone with her thoughts. The look on Rael Avaros's face, that would stay with her for a while. She'd seen hints of that kind of guilt and sorrow before, but only when he talked about Nim Piana, the Padawan who had died. Fanry had never expected to see him that scared for her. But there was nothing to be afraid of. Fanry refused to give in to distractions or doubts now. The ceremony would take place so very soon. Darren would be there to protect her, Orth and Kahl would be there to watch her, and even Katie would be there to help her. Everything would proceed according to plan. A small quiver of uncertainty shivered through her, but Fanry squelched it. Timidity might be all right for little princesses who still covered their hair. Not for a queen. Qui-Gon helped settle the various riders after the hunt, losing track of Obi-Wan during the process. At the end, he found Obi-Wan in the stables, standing in his viractyl stall and absently scratching the beast on its neck.
"I think you're turning into a rider,"
Qui-Gon said.
"Master?"
Obi-Wan looked up hurriedly.
Yes, I like riding a lot more than I expected to, but you need to see this."
He let Rael rattle him,
Qui-Gon thought, as he stepped into the viractyl stall.
"Obi-Wan needs to stand up better than that."
Then he saw his apprentice was holding a datapad. On its screen were images of the sabotaged crab droid, or what remained of it. This was what had shaken Obi-Wan.
"You've learned something." "Not much, I'm afraid. But I wanted you to see this."
Obi-Wan expanded one area to reveal a sort of shield device, one totally unfamiliar to Qui-Gon.
"Do you know of any shields like this?"
"No, I've never seen anything like it. I'm no weapons expert, but this is definitely unusual."
Qui-Gon took the datapad into his own hands. "The shield doesn't connect to the main power supply."
"What was in its cell?"
"Destroyed, according to Darren. His team dug out nothing but ash." Obi-Wan looked sheepish.
I may have swung my lightsaber directly into it as it fell."
Qui-Gon briefly touched Obi-Wan's shoulder.
"It's all right, you couldn't have known."
The shielding must have been centered on the body of the droid, not the legs, where Qui-Gon had struck. Once system's failure began, the shield would have lost power, and of course, a lightsaber could pierce any shield in time.
"There's something else, too. Darren's still going over the security footage, but they've found just one image of interest so far."
Obi-Wan brought it up on the screen. There, amid a thicket in a narrow ravine, was the outline of a human, crouched low, holding something that might have been a remote tether to the droid. The image revealed little, but Qui-Gon thought one element of the image wasn't a trick of the night. All they knew about their attacker was that this person had been completely clothed in black.
Chapter 19.
I don't see why we don't just leave,
Pax complained as he stretched out on the long cushioned bench in the mess hold of the Merricks.
As of yesterday, thanks to my exemplary skill at negotiation, we've made a profit on our trip to Pigel. And if we've left the system, do you really think the Jedi are going to take time out from searching for terrorists to track down two jewel thieves?
From where she stood, pouring herself a cup of Chandrillon tea, Rahara gave him a withering look. He sighed.
Two independent marketers of unregistered gemstones, then?
He was hoping to stoke a conversation of some length and fervor, which would fill the dull time they had to pass waiting for the Jedi. It might also bring a flush to Rahara's cheeks if she got wound up enough. He knew this wasn't a good enough reason to wind her up, but he seemed to do that whether he meant it or not, so he saw no reason not to enjoy the aesthetic effects. Pax considered arguing a hobby. Rahara only shrugged.
We made a promise to the Jedi. I like to keep my promises.
Besides, if Zerka's on high alert, I'd rather stay put for now. Better to leave when they won't be on their guard. With this, she took her steaming mug of tea and wandered back toward her quarters.
Disappointing. His invitation for a vigorous row had been declined. Apparently, sulking was a bad habit, one he was supposed to be breaking, so he resisted the urge. But he couldn't help thinking fondly of the ship where he'd grown up, where everything had made so much more sense.
Oh, heavens,
Z-3PO had said when she found 5-year-old Pax hiding in the equipment locker.
A child. A human one. Quite alive. Whatever are we to do?
Copper-plated G-3PO bent down to study Pax, who was too terrified to speak yet.
Are you sure it's human? It's rather pale.
Z-3PO swiveled on her jointed torso, revealing more of the coiled wires within.
Am I sure? I'm programmed to recognize more than 30,000 sentient species, you know. Of course I can identify a human.
That made G-3PO totter back a few steps.
How rude. Is this the thanks I get for trying to help you identify a stowaway?
Whatever are the two of you bickering about?
Said blue and silver B-3PO, shuffling into the hold.
Oh my, a human.
I told you so,
Z-3PO said. And that was more or less the way every day of Pax's life had unfolded, from the age of 5 until the age of 20, when the ship had at last been found by a Republic cruiser. He'd been the center of the droid's universe, the one human on board amid 83 droids who had all been programmed to serve humans and other sentients, and was thrown off by the fact that now he didn't seem to be the center of anyone else's universe. Except, of course, his own. The droids had all been cheerful about their recovery because they were ready to get back to work. This had convinced Pax he shouldn't be sad either. Really, in his opinion, all beings ought to behave more like protocol droids. What exactly was wrong with that? A great deal, it seemed, but Pax didn't intend to change himself to fit the universe. If the universe wanted him to blend more, well, then it could change to fit him. Rapping against the Merrick's hatch startled Pax, then irritated him. He went to open the door, muttering,
"If only someone had invented comlinks, then nobody would have to knock like some primitive..."
The hatch slid open to reveal Qui-Gon Jinn, solid and genial, and Obi-Wan Kenobi, small, wiry, curious.
"Oh, bliss," Pax said. "Just what I needed this morning."
"We made arrangements yesterday to return to the source of those strange life signs,"
Qui-Gon pointed out, obnoxiously in Pax's opinion, even though the Jedi was correct.
"Are you and Ms. Wick ready for the trip?"
"Ready? No. Stuck?"
"Yes," Pax sighed.
All right, then, let's go.
The slicer dart. The crab droid. Someone wanted to kill Fenry. Someone wanted to ruin the future of the entire planet of Pygel. And this someone also wanted to make damn good and sure to hurt Avaros at the same time. Hale and Nazaka must figure I don't care about Pygel or Fenry. Avaros brooded as he stalked along the castle grounds at dawn, his old boots already crusted with mud. Or if she does give me enough credit to care, she's so angry it doesn't matter. She wants to make this personal. Force knows why. Well, if Azaka wanted a grudge match, she could have one. He grabbed his communicator and called, Darren! The man was undoubtedly already up. We need to review procedures.
At your service, Lord Regent, Darren said, not via comm, but only a few meters away, and now walking straight toward Avaros.
The man's timing was uncanny, exactly as it should be for a captain of the guard. But then why wasn't he applying some of that foresight to Fanry's attackers? Avaros bit back his irritation.
You could have told me you were coming out here to search.
Forgive me, Lord Regent. I believed you would expect me to do so.
Darren bowed his head.
I did inform Master Jin, so that he and his apprentice could return to their investigations on the moon. But I should have let you know regardless, if only so you wouldn't feel the need to search the grounds yourself.
Both of us doing the same job isn't necessarily helping Fenry, Avaros said, unless one of us is doing his job wrong.
Darren drew himself upright, as firmly stiff and correct as ever, but Avaros could see the pain in his eyes.
If you feel that I should not be in Her Serene Highness's service any longer.
Come on, that's not what I meant.
With a sigh, Avaros put away his comm unit.
You're the one person on this whole planet that I can be sure doesn't want Fenry dead, and I only trust you because by now if you wanted to kill Fenry, you could have done it 20 times over.
Her life is more sacred to me than my own,
Darren said solemnly, the way someone might swear an oath. His expression and bearing remained as rigid as though he were carved from a black bark tree. Did the guy ever wear casual robes, swimming suits, even pajamas? Avaros had lived in the same castle as Darren for 8 years now and never once seen the guy out of uniform. Never seen that uniform be anything less than pristinely correct. Never heard Darren call him anything but Lord Regent. Most people who lived and worked together in such close quarters would have become friends by this point. That or bitter enemies. Darren remained at a remove.
No, not Darren, Avaros thought. Me, I'm the one at a remove. Every single human in the palace besides Fenry has made sure of that. Just like it was back at the temple. Just like always.
Dooku had told Rael many times that his isolation was a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Do you not keep your own customs, rather than adopt those of the Jedi around you? Do you refuse to explain yourself more often than not? Why then does it surprise you that you stand apart from the rest?
Master Dooku had liked that about his Padawan, had always encouraged it. So Rael had cultivated that quality within himself. His isolation was at least half his own doing. Yet the solitude kept its sharp edge always.
I wasn't sure, sir,
Darren said, lifting the scanner he held.
What kinds of searches you were running? I've been looking for repulsor lift signatures that would reveal speeder activity, in case that's how they're slipping in and out. But if you're doing the same, I could...
I've done that. I've reviewed the safety droids, even sent probes down to check the coastline in case they were coming in via submersibles. Nothing. Not even a picture. Except that one blurry guy in the brush.
Avaros felt wired. Every muscle was tense. Nothing was right, and nothing could be right until the treaty was signed and nothing was safe. Darren bowed his head once more.
I swear to you, Lord Regent, I've run all such searches before and will do so again personally.
What do you feel is going on here?
Avaros met Darren's eyes, searching for the man inside the uniform.
What does your gut tell you? Forget the evidence or politics or anything else. I want instinct.
After a long pause, Darren said,
I obey procedures, sir. Not instincts.
Like a black barkwood door being slammed in my face.
Avaros thought,
All right. Just go back to what you were doing.
Captain Darren immediately returned to his tasks. Maybe he was grateful not to have to talk to Avaros any longer. Maybe he just didn't give a damn.
More likely the latter.
Seabirds shrieked as they began their morning flight, circling high overhead. Avaros remembered what he'd sworn to himself when he first arrived on Pygel and saw Fanry, only 6 years old and newly orphaned, clinging to her slave girl in their loneliness. He'd looked down at her and inwardly promised,
Nobody else matters. Nothing else matters. Not the Jedi Council. Not politics. Not glory. Not me. Just you.
But it was becoming clear to him that he should have made more friends in the palace. If he had, maybe he'd have a better idea who their enemies were. He stared at the horizon, where the setting moon showed as a pale sliver against the brightening sky. Qui-Gon was up there trying to find Hayla Nazca. Maybe his fresh perspective would let him do it. Avaros wished he was with him, because Hayla Nazca's opposition needed to be hit hard. Harder than Qui-Gon Jinn would ever allow. That was Avaros' job.
I'd like your opinion,
Qui-Gon said. Obi-Wan looked up from the Merrick's scanners. Well, that's a first. The look Qui-Gon gave him made Obi-Wan realize,
I don't think I should have said that out loud, even if it's true.
But maybe Qui-Gon saw truth in it too, because he said only,
I had a curious dream about the treaty ceremony.
Not prophecy, I hope.
Obi-Wan joked. Then his heart sank as he took in Qui-Gon's expression.
It hadn't been a joke at all. Obviously not literal prophecy.
Qui-Gon said, unusually tentative.
But I wondered whether my dream might not be worth analyzing. Perhaps my subconscious has picked up on some clues that we haven't noticed consciously.
Obi-Wan figured that if Qui-Gon was finally asking for his opinion, he could have it.
Surely we have more pressing concerns, better ways of searching for an answer. Dream analysis would be guesswork at best.
Qui-Gon frowned. Maybe this was the beginning of an argument. Obi-Wan braced himself, then startled as the sensors began chiming.
Looks like we're here. Same place as yesterday.
Rahara Wick slid into the seat next to him, double-checking the readings.
And I'm picking up even higher levels of concentrated protons.
Protons?
Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon shared a look, their disagreement forgotten.
That indicated weaponry. Torpedoes or missiles, probably. Anybody who had missiles had other weapons, too. Had the opposition finally been found?
All right, put it down,
Qui-Gon commanded. As Rahara obeyed, Pax Marifer rolled his eyes, something he did often. Obi-Wan wondered whether maybe it was a medical condition. Pax proclaimed,
The only thing worse than being made to search for a guerrilla army is being made to face one.
You're not facing anyone, Pax,
Qui-Gon said.
You're staying on the ship, as is Rahara. This is for me and my apprentice.
Despite everything, Obi-Wan felt a small surge of pride.
Qui-Gon does trust me, at least in some things. I've earned that much from him anyway.
Rahara brought the Merrick's down low until its bottom hull brushed along some treetops.
Obi-Wan followed his master to the hatch, which Rahara had already released for them. Silently, Qui-Gon pried the door open. Strong winds whipped into the bay,